Gaurangal, glories to Srila Prabhupada. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th Canto, Chapter 13, Text 34. Tataha Pravayaso Gopas Tokaslesa Sunivritta Kritrach Janair Apagatas Tad Anusmriti Udashrava. Tata prayaso, no. Tata pravayaso gopas. Tata pravayaso gopas. Toka shlesha sunivrita. Toka shlesha sunivrita. Kritshach janar apagatas. Kritshach chenar upagatas Tat anusmrit yudashrava Tat anusmrit yudashrava Tatapravayaso gopas Tokashlesha sunivrita Kritshach chenar apagatas Tad anusmit yudashrava. Others, please. Vaishnavis. Translation and purport by His Divine Grace. Well, first, actually, sorry, word for word first. Tataha, thereafter. Pravayasa, elderly. Gopa, cowherd men. Toka Aslesha Sunivrita. Became overjoyed by embracing their sons. Kritrat. With difficulty. Shanai. Gradually. Apagata. Ceased from that embracing and returned to the forest. Tat anusmriti udashrava. As they remembered their sons, tears began to roll down from their eyes. Translation of purport by His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. Thereafter, the elderly cowherd men, having obtained great feeling from embracing their sons, gradually and with great difficulty and reluctance, ceased embracing them and returned to the forest. But as the men remembered their sons, tears began to roll down from their eyes. Purport. In the beginning, the cowherd men were angry that the cows were being attracted by the calves. But when the men came down from the hill, they themselves were attracted by their sons, and therefore the men embraced them. To embrace one's son and smell his head are symptoms of affection. Omagina timidam dasha jananjana shalakaya chakshur namalitam yena tasmai shri gurudevena maha shri chaitanya manobhishtam stapitam yena bhutale swayamrupa gadamayam tadapti swapanatikam. So this is a really amazing pastime that we're hearing about. Very spectacular. Krishna has expanded into all the cowherd boys and the calves. And that is really amazing to be able to do that. Now, earlier on this chapter, just so to give you an idea of just how amazing that is, it's mentioned here in the purport, Prabhupada says, according to the Vedas, Ekam Bahusham, the personality of Godhead can become many, many millions upon millions of calves and cowherd boys. Okay, so, you know, it's Prabhupada saying potentially he could do that. And then he goes on to say, as he did to bewilder Brahma more and more. So he did it. So I don't know if initially when Krishna went out to the, you know, that day to have his, take care of the calves and have his picnic with his cowherd boyfriends, if there were initially millions and millions upon millions of calves and cowherd boys, but at some point he did that. Prabhupada says he did it to bewilder Brahma. So maybe he just displayed more of them. So that's pretty amazing to be able to do that. I mean, just to expand is pretty amazing. Has anybody here done any expanding lately? Is there any... Get rid of, oh, right, right, put on weight. It's mentioned that the yogis can sometimes expand to as many as 9 forms, but they're all mirror-like expansions. Like, in other words, when one expansion is going like this, all the expansions go like that. It's just like, you know, television or something like that. So they can do that, which is something. I mean, an ordinary person would consider that pretty amazing and miraculous. But Krishna is expanding as forms which are all individuals. Actually, this, if you analyze it, this pastime, is, as far as the expansion aspect of it goes, is even more amazing than the pastime where Krishna expanded as 16,108 Krishnas to reciprocate with 16,108 wives in their separate palaces. Because at that time, it was Krishna expanding as himself. So this is kind of a, I hope it's a little bit of a speculation. I hope it's a philosophical speculation. I would say it's easier to expand as yourself because you know yourself. You are yourself than something else. I mean, just imagine if you were trying to, if you're able to do it, expand your computer. What would be easier, to expand your computer at home 100 or 1,000 times, or to expand everybody else's computer in this room? You know the information on your computer. It's not a totally new thing to you, but like everybody else's computer, who knows what's on everybody else's computer? So Krishna was expanding himself 16,108 times in that pastime in Dwarka. Here he's expanding as millions and millions upon millions of calves and cowherd boys to further, you know, teach, to reciprocate with Lord Brahma, to teach Lord Brahma a lesson and like that. So that's pretty incredible. That's like, you know, as far as expanding goes, this is, I think this is the most amazing pastime as far as that goes. Now, another interesting aspect that's coming out here in this particular text is that it's describing how the cowherd men, how they were feeling upon meeting their offspring, their sons. And it seems like, you know, they obtained great feeling from embracing their sons. Gradually, with great difficulty and reluctance, they ceased embracing them and returned to the forest. But as the men remembered their sons, tears began to roll down from their eyes. It doesn't specifically state it, but I would say that this is more than what they ordinarily experienced. I mean, I'm sure that these cowherd men had a lot of affection for their offsprings, for their sons, but it's, you know, Sukadev Goswami is bothering to mention this to emphasize the point that this was something more, above and beyond what they usually experienced. And that, well, of course, we know the reason for that was that those sons that they were embracing were actually Krishna. So what was happening was they were experiencing love for Krishna. They were actually experiencing an awakening of Krishna praying upon embracing their offspring, their children. And that's why they had that experience of they felt, you know, great feeling of affection but when embracing their sons, great difficulty and reluctance to stop embracing them. And even when they did stop embracing them, they couldn't stop thinking about it. You know, even when they went back to the forest and tried to get back into their, you know, their duties, what they were supposed to be doing, they kept remembering how wonderful it was embracing their sons, how much they loved their son, which was actually Krishna, and tears were coming from those. They were, you know, actually crying in ecstatic love of God. So this is pretty amazing. And another thing is that they didn't even realize that what was going on, because they were experiencing love for Krishna without even being consciously aware that they were experiencing love for Krishna. So that's pretty amazing and mysterious. Now, the question comes up, is there any other example of this in any of any of our literatures of something like this happening, somebody experiencing love for Krishna without even being aware that that's what's happening to them? Actually, there is. There's another story where this something like this happens. It's in the pastimes of Lord Chaitanya. Lord Chaitanya was in Jagannath Puri, and in the latter part of his life, during the last, he spent, let's see, how many years did he spend in Jagannath Puri? 18 altogether, right, in Jagannath Puri? 12 doing kirtans and everything with all the devotees. The last 6 were in seclusion? No, I think it's the other way around. 6 years during the kirtans and I think 12 years. Anyway, during that period where he was kind of in seclusion, living in the Gambira, Kasi Mishra's house with Sarup Damodar and Ramananda Roy, his regular program was in the evening. Sarup Damodar could kind of sense, you know, what the Lord's mood was, you know, what he was, and he would recite verses to kind of enhance that, you know, to help him go deeper into that ecstasy. So that's what was going on this particular evening. He was chanting or reciting a verse about how Krishna was enjoying with the gopis in the Yamuna, in the river there, and how he was going in and, you know, the pastimes they were engaging in there. So Lord Chaitanya was getting really absorbed in that. And they were going for a walk. They were going someplace with a group of devotees. And then all of a sudden, Lord Chaitanya disappeared. No, it was the devotees, you know, they were just walking and talking. And then I guess they kind of looked off. They weren't paying attention. And it's described how Lord Chaitanya, at the speed of the mind, he shot off. And then they looked around, you know, and they find, where's Lord Chaitanya? And he was nowhere to be, you know, seen, because he dashed off. What happened was Lord Chaitanya, he saw, they were obviously near the beach, and he was looking at the waves. It was evening, it was nighttime, and they were looking at the waves and the ocean there, and he was seeing the black water, and it was reminding him of the Jamuna. So when he immediately started running towards that, you know. So Lord Chaitanya is gone, and they're looking, where is Lord Chaitanya? And so here's another interesting point. Now, these are these confidential associates of Lord Chaitanya. So they had, one could say, with kind of some confidence, that they had love for Krishna. You know, they were advanced devotees. They were elevated devotees. But there's one sentence in that pastime which is describing how it says they were overwhelmed with moroseness, almost unconscious. See, so I'm mentioning that to further elaborate on this point, how This love of Godhead is a mysterious, it's a very mysterious phenomena. You know, it's very confidential. We're going to get to the confidential part, but it's a very mysterious phenomena. You could be experiencing love of Godhead and you don't even know it. You could be experiencing love for Krishna and you simultaneously, you're feeling overwhelmed with moroseness. You're almost unconscious. This is what's being mentioned here. Anyway, so they were going and looking here and there, and then finally, at one point, Srup Damodar decided, you know what, I'm going to take this path. You guys go this way. I'm going to go down here. And I'm going to So he started heading towards the beach, Srup Damodar. And so nothing, wasn't seeing anything that was particularly interesting. But then a fisherman was approaching him from the distance. And this fisherman was behaving a little bit unusually for a fisherman. The fisherman was laughing and crying and singing and dancing. And, you know, and as he and he's came closer, as he came within hearing range, Lord Chaitanya could understand, Srup Damodar could understand that he was chanting continuously, Hari, 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 Hari. And, you know, he's singing and dancing, laughing and crying, and he's chanting, Hari, Hari, Hari. And Srup Damodar, so he stopped him and he said, what's going on? What have you experienced? Have you seen something unusual? And so the fisherman explained to him that what happened was I'm a fisherman, you know, and I catch fish at night like that. So I was on my boat, and I thought I caught a big fish. And when I started to pull in the net, I saw it wasn't a fish. It was a corpse, I believe. You know, he was a little bit confused himself. It was a corpse, I believe. And I immediately got very scared upon seeing it, and I wanted to get out of my net. But when I went to get the corpse out of the net, I touched the corpse, and at that point, a ghost from the corpse entered into my body. And I became overwhelmed with fear, and I was shivering, my hairs were standing on end, but at the same time I was feeling very strange in other ways too. So finally he managed to do that. He managed to get the corpse, it wasn't a corpse, of course it was Lord Chaitanya, out of the net and place him on the shore. And then he was, you know, now he was, I don't know, fleeing, or anyway, he was leaving the place. So Srup Damodar found him in that state, and he was very agitated. He was very agitated. And and he explained to Srup Damodar, who asked him, well, so now what? Where are you going? And he said, I need an exorcist. I need somebody to get this ghost out of me, you know, because I can't go, I can't function like this. This is too much, you know. I mean, he was simultaneously experiencing love, ecstatic love for Krishna, but he was in a lot of anxiety and fear somehow at the same time. Which is also a little unusual, but anyway, that's another mysterious thing. So Srup Damodar said, oh, you're very fortunate. Actually, I happen to be a very famous exorcist. I'll help you out. So it's described how Srup Damodar put his hands on his head, and it mentions in the chapter introduction, but not in the actual text itself, but he chanted some mantras, and in the chapter introduction it mentions he chanted the Maha Mantra. So he put his hand on his head, and he chanted the Maha Mantra, and then he slapped him three times. And he said, you're okay now. And the fisherman kind of calmed down, and he was a bit peaceful. And he said, and Srup Damodar then explained to him, actually, that person that you, and now he was in a more calm state, he could talk to him, that person that you took out of, that wasn't a corpse, or, you know, that was Lord Chaitanya. And the fisherman said, no, it can't be. I know the Lord. I've seen him many times. You know, he was an inhabitant of Jagannath Puri. But no, this person, his body was, it was like elongated. He was between, how do you put it, 5 to 7 cubits long. And a cubit is about 1.5 feet. So that means he was between 7.5 to 10.5 feet long. That's how Lord Chaitanya. And his joints, his limbs, were 3 cubits long, which is about 4.5 feet. Yeah, 4.5 feet long. That's long. I mean, I think my arm is about, maybe that's what, 3 feet maximum? 2.5, 3 feet? Anyway, Lord Chaitanya is about like the distance from here to the base there for Tulsi plant. So, you know, he was a bit of a devotee too. I skipped this detail, but this fisherman was not an ordinary person, as probably most of the inhabitants of Jagannath Puri at that time weren't. He mentioned that he used to chant in the Sringa mantra to protect himself from being attacked by ghosts when he was out at night fishing, you know, on the water there. But he said when he did that this time, he did it when he found Lord Chaitanya, he said the strength of the ghost redoubled. whenever he chanted that, then he felt more like, you know, affected by, quote unquote, the ghost or that you know, the influence of Lord Chaitanya within him. So anyway, Sukhdamatar explained that to him, and he said, "No, that's the Lord," and he calmed down. He said, "Where exactly was he?" And they took him. They went together to the place where Lord Chaitanya was, and they sure enough, they found Lord Chaitanya lying on the beach there, and he was all full of sand, and he was still kind of more or less he was unconscious. It was described that Lord Chaitanya had three states of consciousness: sometimes he was fully absorbed in, you know, internally in Krishna praying like that. Sometimes he was half in and half out, where he would be speaking and he'd be somewhat aware of his surroundings, but mostly he was just absorbed in this internal consciousness, and then something normal, like, you know, external consciousness. So at this point he was totally internal. And so the other devotees arrived, and they started chanting the Hare Krishna mantra very loudly in his ear in order to revive him. And after some time, sure enough, Lord Chaitanya revived consciousness. Immediately, his body resumed its normal shape. You know, his limbs retracted, everything became normal again. And but he only returned to what's called Ardha Baiha, half consciousness, half external consciousness. He was still, in that state, he was talking about what he had been experiencing while he was in that other state. And but anyway, it's another example of a pastime. This person, he had love for Krishna, and he didn't even realize that's what was going on. I'm just mentioning this to point out how mysterious this love of Krishna is. And I already mentioned about how the devotees, they were feeling overwhelmed by moroseness, almost unconscious. And of course, Lord Chaitanya, just the things he was experiencing and manifesting himself, he was totally absorbed in love for Krishna. One could say, well, but he's Krishna himself. That doesn't count. But it does count, because Lord Chaitanya, he is Krishna himself, but he's in the role of a devotee. So, you know, it's sort of his manifestations of love for Krishna are also, you know, in that category of manifestations of love for Krishna. So anyway, from these things we can understand that this love for Krishna, this is a very big subject, by the way. I'm just giving, you know, a few little examples. Actually, it's the biggest subject. This is the biggest subject, and I'll tell you why. I've heard Prabhupada say repeatedly in many, many lectures that there are millions and trillions of universes. I'm just trying to make sure I get it right. Yeah, millions and trillions. No, millions and trillions. There's millions of universes, and in each one of these, sorry, this is the correct way. I've heard Prabhupada say this more than once. There are millions of universes, and in each universe there are millions and trillions of planets. Okay, so that means it's pretty big. You know, the material universe is the Mahatattva is pretty big. Okay, but as big as it is, it's only ekapad vibhuti. It's only 1/3 of the entire manifestation. 1/4. Sorry. Thank you. 1/4. And as I mentioned in some previous classes, Prabhupada said, when he was asked, "Do all the souls come here to the material world?" And Prabhupada said 10%, and then he paused for a second. He said, "Actually, no, less than 10%. So take whichever one you like, but you know, this is actually not insignificant, but it's not. The spiritual world is much more significant. And what's going on in the spiritual world? The spiritual world is a place where the psychological dynamic that predominates the spiritual world is love for Krishna, Krishna praying. You see, so in that sense, it's the biggest subject, because in most of the creation, if you include the spiritual world there, the main thing that's going on is love for Krishna. So this is a very big subject. So it's very mysterious. It's very confidential. On this point of confidential, I wasn't able to find the verse, but I'm sure I'm positive I've heard this in the nectar. I think it's from the Nectar Devotion, that Krishna awards dharma, artha, kama, and even moksha pretty easily. I mean, you know, there's some qualification required, but you can get it. But he's very careful about who he awards love of Krishna to, because you can get moksha, but not, it's getting love for Krishna, that's very, very difficult. It's very confidential, because Krishna is purchased by that, meaning that he comes under the control of the devotee or the bhakta. So he's very careful, and he has his you know, energies also working, and they have that instruction. So it's very, you know, it's confidential. It's very difficult to get love for Krishna. So my point is this, that and this is like, you know, getting to the lesson part of the class. What's the lesson for us from all these points? Is that to get love for Krishna, if you know, analyzing these different ideas, you're not going to get it by any ascending process. In other words, nobody's going to be able to get love for Krishna by their intellectual prowess, by any endeavor on their part, wholly and solely. You know, it's not going to happen. See, I'll elaborate a little bit more on that point, why that would be impossible. Yesterday, after the class, we were, a group of us, a few devotees here, came up and we were sitting here with Garuda Prabhu, and we were talking. At one point, and I can't remember exactly what the point at that on the table was at that moment, but he mentioned that according to medical science, each human being is approximately 27 trillion cells in 37 trillion cells in the human body. Each one of those has 1 million moving parts. Okay, so my point is this: what kind of person would be capable of producing a machine or a garment? Because both body is both those things. It's like it's a machine that we're wearing. It's a machine as we're wearing as a garment. So what kind of person would be capable of producing a body, let's just simplicity's sake, that has 37 trillion cells approximately, and each one of those has 1 million moving parts? A really powerful and a really intelligent person, right? I mean, obviously, you know, that's not just anybody in their little workshop. And a really powerful and a really intelligent person would be required to produce something as amazing as the human body, okay? So if somebody that smart and that powerful doesn't want you to understand, you know, the confidential things about having a relationship with them, or you're not going to be able to understand it. You're not going to be able to understand it. It's like thinking you could bust out of solitary confinement or something like that. You're overpowered. There's no way we're going to be able to understand love for Krishna unless Krishna, you know, that person, that incredibly powerful and incredibly intelligent person, actually allows us to. That's the only way we're going to understand it. So that's one lesson that, you know, forget about this idea. It's that verse, Jnane Prayasam Uda Pashyanamanta Eva. It's recommended. That was the first verse that Lord Chaitanya accepted when he was talking with Ramananda Roy, you know, as being a suitable answer for how does one achieve the goal of life. Rendering submissive oral reception to spiritually realized people. But in the very first part of it, as Archita pointed out to me after a previous class I gave when I mentioned, quoted this verse, that the first thing is Jnane Prayasam Uda Pashyanamanta Eva. You have to throw out this process of mental speculation. You have to throw out this process of trying to understand the absolute, or what to speak of experience, even understand the absolute by the strength of our own mind and intelligence. Ain't going to work. Not going to work. See? So we have to forget about that. And just elaborating a little bit upon that, just to, you know, to help us better understand how that couldn't work. The mind is limited. Just like I many, many years ago, I was listening to this a recording of a seminar Sataputta Prabhu gave down in San Diego. So he was asked, I think Bhadri Narayan Maharaj was in the audience, and he asked this question about, you know, you say we can't gain knowledge by the ascending process, but that doesn't seem to be the case. I mean, look, you know, if you turn back the clock 1,000 years, we were going around on carts drawn by horses, and now we have automobiles. And, you know, if you turn back the clock a bit further, people were living in very simple thatched huts and things. Now we have skyscraper buildings with air conditioning, heating, electricity, plumbing. So, you know, it seems like we can acquire knowledge by the ascending process, you know, by using our intellect and using our different abilities, we can make progress and, you know, improve things. But Sataputta pointed out, yes, but there's a limit. There's a limit. And he said, he gave the example. The analogy he used was just say, like, you're trying to jump. And I was thinking myself, I might be able to jump if I had to, like a high jump, maybe the height of this. And if I practice for a week or a month, maybe I could get a little bit higher. I could get improve by about 3, 4, 5, possibly as many as 6 inches. But very unlikely that I'm going to be able to do double that, no matter how hard I try. You see? There's a limit. You know, there's a limit to how far we can go on the using our the strength of the prowess, our intelligence and our abilities like that. Just a more vivid example of that is throughout the world, probably to the according to the World Health Organization, human longevity has been increased. Maybe if you turn back the clock 100 years, the average age for a human being would be, say, average lifespan would be 65 years. And now say like it's 75 years. Okay, so that's what is that? Is that a 10% increase? Perhaps a little bit more. So that's significant. And there are quite a few people who live to be 100. Okay? But that's good. But it's limited. How many people are living to be 1,000? You know, there might be a bunch of, they call them centenarians or something like that. How many millennials are there? How many people are there that are living to be 1,000? See, there's a limit, what to speak of immortal. So some progress can be made, but it's limited. So in the same way, you can understand a certain amount of stuff using your intelligence, but you only go so far. So the process is we have to engage in devotional service. You know, all throughout the Bhagavad Gita, all the the Vedic literatures, so many different times, just like Garuda Prabhu mentioned, I can't remember if it was during the class or in the discussion afterwards, there are 27 times in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna says, talks about coming, the soul should come to him. 22 places in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna mentions about how the soul, he talks about that subject of the soul coming to him. I wonder how many places, maybe you've also done an inventory survey of this one as well, how many places are there where Krishna says he can't be understood, he can only be understood by devotional service? Did you ever do that one? 4. Okay, well, that's pretty good. And I'm sure it's something, this certain number in the Bhagavatam and other places as well. So that's the process for understanding Krishna, engaging in devotional service. And, of course, all devotional services are wonderful, but, and we'll make progress by engaging in any of the 9 processes of devotional service, but ideally, if we can engage in devotional service, following in the footsteps, the more closely we can engage in devotional service, following in the footsteps of the acharyas, and in particular our acharya, the more effective it's going to be, the more potent it's going to be. The more closely we can follow the acharya. So another interesting thing, Garuda, in a conversation we're having after the class, he mentioned that he was the MC for the 50th anniversary celebration of Prabhupada's arrival into the Boston Harbor, which was last year sometime. And so he was, as part of his service as the MC, he was arranging who would speak, and he gave him a theme. He gave everybody a theme because he didn't want it to just be all over the place, just general glorification of Prabhupada. He wanted something, to very zero in, hone in specifically on this particular incident. And so he asked everybody to address this particular point, which is, what does Prabhupada's arriving on the Jaladuta in Boston Harbor mean to you? That was the specific theme or thing they had to speak on. Is that correct? So when he said that, I was thinking, immediately I thought to myself, well, what would I have said if I was there? Really something shot to my mind. I think, well, what came to my mind was, what I would have spoken about is what an amazing risk Prabhupada took and how much sacrifice he made, to do that, because it's described how he had 2 heart attacks on the way coming over. He was coming over not knowing anybody, without any money, etc., etc., etc. And then also, I didn't mention this yesterday when we were talking, but then when I further thought about it, I thought, I also should have probably said something about Prabhupada's motive for doing that. His motive for doing that would be just to please his spiritual master. That was his motive for doing that. There's no material motivation for doing that. He was just doing that to please his spiritual master. What was the spiritual master trying to do? What's the really underlying motive? It's to please Krishna by doing what Krishna wants all the devotees to do, and the acharyas are like the personifications of this, which is try to help the conditioned souls come back to him, back to the 22. you know, in the Bhagavad Gita. It's all about helping souls come back to Krishna, you see? So Prabhupada was trying to assist his spiritual master in his mission, which is the same mission as all the spirit, of trying to help souls come back to Krishna, because that's what Krishna wants. Krishna wants souls coming back. So the acharyas are surrendered to that. They're tuned in to that particular desire, you know, of engaging in devotional service in such a way, as I said, any devotional service you engage in, it's glorious, it's wonderful, it's purifying, it's potent, etc. But as we advance, I think we're going to, as a devotee advances, he'll focus, he'll hone in more on this particular aspect of devotional service, which is perhaps the most important. And Krishna says at the end of the Bhagavad Gita, you know, that verse where he's, two verses where he talks about, and the devotee is most dear to me, you know, it's the one who shares this message with the other devotees, tries to help them become devotees like that. So that's there. So, and that's what Prabhupada was doing, and that's what we have to try to do. That's what we have to try to do, focusing on that desire of bringing devotees, bringing souls back to Krishna. And as I mentioned, might have mentioned in a question I asked in class yesterday. I can't remember when I mentioned it, but there's this very nice purport in the 8th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam in the prayers to Gajendra, where Prabhupada says in his purport, he's talking about this particular quality, and he goes, only Krishna can deliver us from material existence. Indeed, he is always trying to deliver us. He is within our hearts and is not at all inattentive. His only aim is to deliver us from material life. It is not that he becomes attentive to us only when we offer prayers to him. Even before we offer our prayers, he incessantly tries to deliver us. He is never lazy in regard to our deliverance. So this is Krishna's program. So therefore, this should be our program. And that is, and of course, it is the program of the acharyas to just act as embodiments or personifications of this particular mood, desire of Krishna, to try to help souls back to Krishna. So wrapping it up, yeah, this is an amazing pastime. Love of God is an amazing subject, and the way we're going to access it, or have it, the best possibility, best chance of being promoted to this platform, awarded, blessed by this topmost goal of life, is by engaging in devotional service, trying to follow in the footsteps of the predecessor acharyas, who are doing nothing other than paying very careful attention to Krishna's most important, what Krishna considers the most important desire, most important aspect of devotional service, which is trying to reclaim his spirit, the rest of his spiritual family, his wayward spiritual offsprings, which is what we are here in this material world. So I'll stop there. 8:15. Anybody questions or comments? Garuda Prabhu. Thank you. Thank you.
Yes. So this theme about loving Krishna when you don't know that you're loving Krishna. You know. So when people come to the temple here, it's very deliberate. They're coming here, they know that devotees will be here, they know that there's some interest mm-hmm. in coming here. So there's some consciousness, awareness that there's something wonderful happening here. But those who go out on book distribution, I was just thinking about book distribution, now I have to confess, whenever I went out on book distribution in the old days, none of the temple presidents liked it too much, because I would take, you know, I sold 2 Bhagavad Gitas in 6 hours, because I would sit and talk to the people for 3 hours each. And now I'm quite sure that they read the Gita after I gave it to them, but you know, I wasn't really a very good book distributor, I have to confess, in front of the king of book distribution here. But you know, it occurs to me that when a book distributor goes out, that, you know, isn't that the job of a book distributor? To be liked and to extend the attractiveness of Krishna. Mm-hmm. So much so that a person will want to take a book. I mean, isn't that the idea? it happens with us. It's not that the book can be immediately attractive, but it's through our behavior that the book will be taken from your hands to another's. So, in a way, a person's encountering devotees distributing books would be, in effect, in that sort of similar position. Liking Krishna through you, by liking you. What do you think? Is that a reasonable parallel there? Yeah? You like that, Swabhas? Yeah, yeah. He rarely likes what I say, so that's pretty good. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I just think that that's such a good model, right? That we need to connect with another person in such a way that they will want to take that book to extend their experience of having met you. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. Instruments.
Instruments, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Archita Papu?
Thank you, Bhrigupati, for a nice class. And Garuda Prabhu, I've known you a long time, and I almost always agree with you. But there's another way of looking at that point. Book distribution is so mystical that even if they don't like you, even if you're not even trying. I was once at a book distribution seminar in Europe, given by Manidhar Prabhu, our god brother. And he was pointing out the different ways in which these books get distributed, sometimes beyond the ability of the distributor. He gave two examples. There was one devotee who's really pretty short, and in Europe a lot of the people there are tall, but he was so bold that he would go up to a 7 foot tall guy and slap him on the back, hey, how you doing, and shove 6 books in his hands. And he was that kind of distributor, very engaging and very personable, and he distributed a lot of books. And then there was this Mataji he gave as a second example, who was very, very shy. She would stand on a corner and she would just like barely show the book, and if the person didn't immediately take it, she would pull it back and she would just stand there. And she also distributed tons of books. Because some or other, just by that little effort like that, people became attracted. And they wanted to know, what is this? Even though she was practically running away, if they didn't engage right away, they would stop her. What do you have there? Let me see that. So it's not necessarily so much our ability to engage. It's Krishna's mercy. She wanted to distribute the book. She had that strong desire. So even though she didn't have that outgoing personality like the other devotee who would slap big guys on the back, hey, how you doing, and give a fist bump, and she wasn't like that. She was very retiring and shy, but still the books went out because she had the desire. So Krishna reciprocated. And I had a personal example of that. I was in JFK once, and I'm like you. I was always in production, never a distributor really. But I was in JFK, and I was having a horrible day. So I stood at one corner of two corridors, huge corridors, and I was just praying, Lord Chaitanya, I'm here. Please engage me. And almost immediately, this guy stopped and said, what do you have there? Bhagavad Gita. He said, 10 years ago I had one, and I gave it to a friend. And ever since then, I've been looking for this book. And he was from France. Somewhere or other, he got a Gita in France, and he was never able to find it again after that, until he saw me. And he bought the book, just like that, just because I was praying sincerely. So sometimes it's not our personality that sells the book. It's that directly and only Krishna's mercy.
Yes, who's next?
I'll make this quick. I have to argue with Archita a little bit here. These are wonderful anecdotes, but you see, I agree with you in the sense that Krishna's grace comes through the devotee despite our certain behaviors at times. As long as it's sincere, So I may be a little timid out on book distribution, but yet somehow Krishna's grace is so strong, it takes over. And I think the whole movement has been successful in spite of us, at times. I mean, I think that, Krishna's a lot stronger than our weaknesses. And it goes on so powerfully, amazingly, So I think in this instance, same thing with book distribution then. But as long as we're sincere in putting ourselves out there, I think that the grace of Krishna takes over and works through us, despite us. But that doesn't mean you can do anything out there. That's my point. Oh.
I think it's an additional thing to that would be desire. If it's the Srila Prabhupada never went out, and that I know, well, he did in the very beginning. He went to bookstores and gave his Bhagavatams. But after that, after we came along, all the devotees, Srila Prabhupada's desire, book distribution went out. So I think that if a devotee is not very good or timid or whatever, I think that just by the desire of wanting to perform that activity, Krishna reciprocates. So on any level, whatever it is, it's I think desire is the most important principle here. You know, you have knowledge, you develop an understanding of what it means to please the guru or the acharya or the administration or whatever. So I think that if one actually develops, because you can force someone to go out, then yeah, they may do one or two books, but if their desire increases to a very high pitch, intense desire, Krishna reciprocates with the devotee.
I think Rabindranath next. And I'll get everybody if I'm allowed to. Rabindranath. And then Sachin.
Yeah, you mentioned how there's different types of devotional service and how devotees should follow the types of devotional service that Srila Prabhupada performs. So what would you say are those different types of devotional service that Prabhupada would specifically perform?
Prabhupada did all the different types of devotional service. Prabhupada engaged us in deity worship. I mean, I guess if you're referring to that, but that's part of the preaching of the Krishna consciousness movement. Prabhupada himself wrote books, of course, and he chanted. But, you know, I think maybe it's more of a question of inner mood than outer activity. I think as we advance, we'll be engaging in whatever activity. We might be cooking in the restaurant. We might be up on the altar worshiping the deities. We might be whatever we're doing. But that mood of doing it, you know, with the desire to seeing it as a service, a way in which I'm assisting to try to bring people to Krishna consciousness will intensify. You know, will increase, will expand and intensify within one's consciousness. That'll become like, you know, when you'll be a pujari, but more and more you'll be absorbed in how this is important for spreading the Krishna consciousness movement here in Los Angeles. That'll become a more prominent part of your consciousness than it was previously as you advance in Krishna consciousness. I don't think a devotee can avoid that, you know, preaching mood and mentality as they advance, because the acharyas, that was, you know, obviously a very primary concern of all the acharyas, and that's why they preached and wrote books and did everything they did. Okay, do you agree with that? Are you satisfied with that answer?
Thank you.
Okay. Who is next? Sachin Anoy.
Thank you, Prabhu. Our philosophy is personalist. We're always preaching that. So I have practical experience of what Rudra Prabhu mentioned. That I'm the practical example of that devotee who was met at the airport by a book distributor. And my impression from the beginning, even through all this time, up to now, after 38 years, is that one, if that person wouldn't have put a lot of personal attention and quality in his distributing the book, they probably wouldn't be here. So we do have examples also of someone just distributing the book and just like, you know, many quantity of books, and somebody found the book in the trash or found the book here and there. That's good too. So another thing I've been observing is that I have practical example of being side to side with different devotees, with different tendencies, with different skills, and some of them not very much inclined in distributing so many books, but what they do is put quality in talking to people, and I love that. And I look at myself and I say, what am I doing here? You know, of course, I'm fulfilling the desire of other devotees, of the management, of temple presidents, of, you know, book distribution, many books, high score. You know, I'm not good in that anyway, but I'm saying. And then I say, this devotee here, so humble, so nice. And I wonder how long he's going to last in the eyes of the management, because he's not producing so much. But something that I really appreciate was, and I was feeling guilty about it, I said, every time I come with this devotee, from the last month or 2 months, everybody comes and shakes hands, talks to him, and to me, they don't talk to me. I didn't make that connection with the other people. So then I was thinking, this devotee is pleasing Krishna, and I wish I could have those qualities, in which I'm probably more passionate, and is still having a set mind in which I have to distribute this quantity of books, or I have to do this much. This is not minimizing, though, you know, the input, I say, the emphasis of distributing the books, thousands, somebody can read them there, here and there. But I'm just making the point that maybe not necessarily spending 6 hours, like Prabhu said, you know, even jokingly, maybe 6 hours, but, you know, like 1 hour, 2 hours, but quality time. And those people will never forget the devotees. I assure that. I've seen it. And I haven't done that so much. But I have seen other devotees who put that quality time. They always remember. They give me the name. They say, have you seen such and such persons? And they never forget. So I just want to make that point about personalism and quality.
Thank you very much. Srinathai? Okay, I guess this last one, Srinathai, and then we'll wrap it up. Thank you.
So I saw a question here. It's pretty awesome. If pure devotees have mystic powers, like all the mystic powers, the cities exist within them, and they can expand, why don't they expand for preaching?
Mm-hmm. The way I've heard Prabhupada describe the mystic powers of devotees is different than the mystic powers like of a yogi. A yogi has mystic powers. They're right at his command. Like, you know, Durvasa Muni, for instance, when he got angry at Maharaj Ambarish, he knew that he's going to pluck that hair out of his head and throw it down there and produce a demon. And there's many other examples. But a devotee, his mystic powers are manifested through his dependence on Krishna. A devotee just depends on Krishna. Maharaj Ambarish also had, you could say, had mystic powers, because Maharaj Ambarish was just depending upon Krishna, whether he was standing there chanting Hare Krishna, just thinking about Krishna. I can't remember the exact detail. But mystically, the Sudarshan Chakra came and started chasing that, you know, demon or whatever. No, started destroyed that demon that Maharaj Ambarish produced by his mystic power and started Durvasa Muni, created by his mystic power, and started chasing Durvasa Muni wherever he flew throughout the universe. So Prabhupada, in lectures, would repeatedly make that point, that a devotee, that they're latent within him in the sense that he's completely depending upon Krishna. It's like sometimes he gave the example of a child who's with his father, depending upon his father. The child doesn't have any power himself, but the child's just completely dependent upon his father, who's very, very powerful. So the devotee just depends on Krishna, and when it's necessary, Krishna will manifest those mystic powers, and it'll seem like the devotee is doing it, but it's actually just Krishna just making it happen through the devotee. That's my understanding. So, thank you very much, everybody, for coming, listening. Grantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam, Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada, Ki Jai.